With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track podcast. I'm Stu Whiffin, I'm your host. I hope you're doing well. Good. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. And today's episode, it's pretty damn wonderful. I went to Ilpi Island. Go and Google that if you don't know where it is, because it was absolutely spectacular. And the reason I went there was to sit and have a pod chat with Blaine Harrison of the Mystery Jets, and it was delightful. Blaine's an absolute gentleman. We had a really nice time, had a good chat, which I'm really excited that you're about to hear. Before we get on with it, I'd just like to thank Scribbis Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to everybody over at podbiblemag.com. And thanks to Mr. 76, the producer. I think that's it. We can just get on with the podcast. So please enjoy today's episode, which is with Blaine Harrison of the Mystery Jets. 76, drop that intro. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year. And they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So, go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk. Official sponsors of Off the Beaten Track podcast. Let's get back to that podcast. It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin. Okay, we're recording. We are... This is without a shadow of a doubt the most beautiful location. Well, it's one of the most beautiful locations I've sat in a long, long time. Yet, not alone to record a podcast. I'm on Ilpi Island, looking out over lots of houseboats and a beautiful river. It's absolutely idyllic. And sitting next to me is Blaine Harrison.
Hello.
All right.
Yeah, very good, thanks.
So we've already had a chat, and we've when you started telling me about, you can't access this island unless you walk across a little footbridge, and it's quite a cracker's environment to walk into, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure it's probably quite normal to you because you've obviously lived there for a long time. But I want to definitely talk about this as this podcast unfolds because it's an incredible place. And I'm sure as we start to talk about the formative years of the band that this place will be quite important.
It is. It's very, I think there's a lot of synergy between definitely the story of the band and the story of the island. We're kind of, you know, we're sort of forever linked, really. I mean, I'm not sure we'd be doing what we do today if it wasn't for, you know, for finding this place. I think it's got magical powers.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think so.
Wonderful. Blaine, I always start this podcast with track one, and that question is, what is the song with the greatest ever intro?
I had to think about this a little bit for a little bit, but actually... there's no doubt in my mind that the song with the greatest intro is Money for Nothing.
Okay.
By Dire Straits. Released, I think it was 1985, the year I was born.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously a vintage year.
Mm-hmm.
The album version, well, first of all, Brothers in Arms was the best-selling record in Britain for the 80s. So it was a monster, 25 million copies, I think it sold worldwide. So it was a huge, huge album. And obviously that song is very associated with the start of MTV. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the video had, I actually watched it back when I was thinking about the intro. And it's still an amazing video. You know, it's got all the kind of hand-drawn, like animations on the video. And his sweatbands light up. It's pretty iconic, cutting edge stuff. But I think one of the things that's so amazing about it, and this isn't a guilty pleasure, by the way. I mean, I don't really believe in the concept of guilty pleasures.
Shouldn't be guilty about a pleasure.
No, I feel absolutely no guilt or remorse in loving Dire Straits. But I think what is one of the things that's so incredible about it is the way you get into the song. I mean, that riff that we all know doesn't come in for a minute and a half.
Yeah, that's the payoff, isn't it?
That's the payoff.
Yeah.
It's really... I think once you're into the riff, you're into the tune, really. It's just... Yeah. But it's the point getting up to that it's like a masterclass in suspense.
Yeah.
There's this... And it... I believe it all came about afterwards. So originally when Knopfler brought the tune into, they're recording in Montserrat, in Air Studios in Montserrat, which I believe was George Martin's studio, one of his. And when he brought in the tune originally, it just started straight with the riff.
Mm.
But the producer, you know, he said, well, what can we do with this? I mean, it's such a massive riff. Like, I feel like we need to build some kind of suspense just so that when it kicks in, you know, you're so ready for it. And it's this layering of the synth pads. It's those kind of like schizoid drum fills and obviously Sting's voice.
Mm-hmm.
The melody is actually the melody.
I'm glad
from...
you sang that, and I didn't try to.
it's actually the melody from "Don't Stand So Close to Me,"
isn't it?
Yeah. So I don't think they realised till afterwards, but he basically recycled the melody. The best version of this song, in my opinion, is actually not the recorded version; it's the Live Aid version.
Live Aid version, yeah.
And Sting's in his full kind of like, you know, white linens.
Of course.
Blowing in the wind. Knopfler's got his sweatbands on. But what's amazing is when the camera turns to look at the crowd, people don't really know the song yet. Because obviously the record probably would have just come out.
85, yeah, of course.
And so people are sort of clapping along, but no one knows the words.
Yeah.
And you're just looking at them and you're thinking, this song is so big, and you're just sort of trying to catch up with it. That would be, in my opinion, one of the greatest intros.
And ever. It is so weird because I would have been 9 or 10 when that came out, and I can remember like that album sleeve like just being everywhere. And then we didn't have MTV, but that video, if you got to see it, it was like, oh my god, you know, you were staring at the future, Blaine. It's amazing.
You still are.
And like, and what's weird is like, I'd like to know how old Mark Knopfler was when they recorded that, because it feels like all of them people looked like my dad's mates in the middle of the 80s, but they were like cutting edge pop stars. And you just think, I wonder how old they were. Like, because I remember, you look at them now and it is weird. I just always have that kind of thing of like, he must have been mid 40s, but you'll probably find out he was like late 20s.
Yeah. Like, he didn't really age for a period of about 20 years. He sort of just looked the same. And he just looked like your mate's dad.
Yeah, completely. You know what I
mean? We actually made a record in Knopfler's studio. We did our third record in his studio. I don't know how... Well, we were on Rough Trade at the time, and I think Jeff Travis must have had access to it. I don't know how, but, you know, it's the most cutting edge. It's like walking aboard... You know, like the Starship Enterprise, it is insane. I mean, they win Best Studio every year, the Golden Mike Award or whatever it is. We were recording in there for our third record, and one day I was sat outside having a fag, and this guy on a scooter pulls up outside, and he's got his helmet on, so I couldn't see who it was. Turned out to be Mark Knopfler. But if you saw the scooter, it was like the most beat up, like crappy scooter. Nothing, we're not talking like Vespa.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking like, a secondhand Honda.
Yeah.
And he shows up and he presses his beeper and, you know, the electric doors go up and he walks in. And we had a little chat and I said, you know, I'm losing my voice, and I'd been trying to do this vocal, and I'd got so frustrated. I went outside for a fag, and he said, "Well, you know, I smoked all the way through the 80s, and you know, I'm not going to tell you to put your fag out because I know how good a cigarette tastes." He said, "But what I used to drink was hot toddies." He said, "That's how he used to hit all the notes." And he came in and had a little listen to the tune, and he was the most down to earth, like lovely man, most unassuming, you know, just showing up on his little scooter. But he is a bona fide rock god.
Arguably one of the biggest rock gods of certainly the 80s, if not all time.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Was there any other considerations for this other than Money for Nothing?
A couple of others crossed my mind. I actually had thought about choosing "Shine On You Crazy Diamond."
Nice.
But I listened to one of your other episodes, which was with Frank Carter, and I think he chose that. I can't remember if he chose it for the intro or for a song that reminded him of his childhood, or I can't remember which one it was. So I thought I'll go for Dire Straits. But that song also has an incredible intro.
Absolutely. Track two, Blaine, the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
This one, there was no question, there was no doubt in my mind. It's "Satellite of Love" by Lou Reed.
Okay. When did you hear that?
I heard that when I was, I would have been about 8 or 9. And at the time I was living in France. So, I mean, there's a little bit of a story about it. It's not hopefully not too much of a weep story. I'll try not to well up. But my parents had separated when I was quite young. And so my sister and I grew up in France, in rural France, with my mum. My dad carried on living in London. And occasionally I would have to fly back for hospital appointments. And I would have been 7 or 8, and my mum would take me to the airport and she'd put me on the flight to London. fly into Heathrow. My dad would pick me up and he'd take me to this hospital appointment. And so they'd be, yeah, once or twice a year. And I think as a kid, getting on a flight on your own was quite scary.
Terrifying.
It was quite scary. And there'd always be, you know, the airline staff would always be lovely and they'd give you like a little colouring book and like a little kiddie meal. But it was really exciting and it was exhilarating, but it was also, there was quite a sort of big emotional component to it, which was coming over, seeing my dad. And usually I'd just have 2 or 3 days with him. Then he'd put me on the plane and I'd fly back to France. And other than that, I'd just see him at Christmas or in the summer holidays. And I remember on one of those occasions, we were driving back from the hostel to the airport for me to fly back home. And he put on Transformer and Satellite of Love came on and something struck me about it. I didn't really understand the lyrics, but the lyrics spoke to me. There was something in the... I suppose if I was to kind of musically try and dissect it, there's this really jovial piano playing, quite jazzy piano sort of arrangement, but with these sort of melancholic descending chords. And in a way, I suppose one shouldn't try and intellectualize it, but just something about the song spoke to me and communicated a feeling that resonated with how I felt. And and I remember on that journey looking, and I was crying, and I remember trying to sort of move my head. I was sat in the back, and I remember trying to move my head so that my dad couldn't see I was crying. But then I caught a glimpse of his eye in the sun visor, and I saw that he was crying. And I just remember it was one of those moments that music really can touch on something incredibly deep, in your experience, in your kind of human experience, which at that age I was too young to understand, but I didn't need to understand it. You know, it was almost like it was a mechanical thing. The music just went in there and did something.
So looking back at that now, the emotion that you would have experienced then, was that longing? Was that sadness? What would you describe that as?
Probably both of those things. Yeah. Just, I think it was that feeling of distance. And, you know, in the song, he's talking about, you know, soon the moon will be filled with parking cars. And it felt like getting in the plane, flying back to France, it felt like going to the moon, you know, because it was so far away from home. And it sort of became my home, really. But I also feel that home is, as a concept, I think home is sort of embodied in your parents' voice. Like wherever your parents are is home. It doesn't really matter where you are. And I think that song really epitomized that feeling for me. And I mean, the other thing about it is it's 3.5 minutes long.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it.
Yeah.
It feels like an opus. It feels like you're going to the moon and back. Yeah. It's a bit like, I always think of the Kinks, This Time Tomorrow, which is like, it's got the aeroplane sounds in it. And it is like this kind of mini symphony. It's like a sort of pocket symphony. And Satellite of Love feels like one of those songs.
Yeah.
The fact that you can achieve that depth of emotion and communicate something so profoundly in 3.5 minutes is a testament to the power of pop music, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. How was living in France?
It was actually wonderful. I went to a very small school. There was 11 kids. There was 3 age groups, 11 kids in total, all being taught in one classroom by this one super teacher who was absolutely incredible.
In French?
French, yeah.
So you can speak French?
Well, what actually happened is that we moved there when I was 8, and I think I was so kind of traumatized by probably having to leave home behind, leave behind London, because I loved London. I still do. It's the city I was born in. I mean, I've got complex feelings about London, but I think when you're born somewhere, there is this sort of inherent attachment to that place. So I think there was something about leaving London, the feeling of being away from my dad, leaving my best mate, Will, who I started the band with. Mm-hmm. And so actually when we went out to France, I didn't speak for the first term. So for the first term of school from September till Christmas, I didn't say a word. My sister was amazing. She was, you know, within a few weeks, she was gossiping with all the other kids and she was like a little French girl. I became a mute. I didn't talk. And I think it was partly a protest, you know, a sort of a childlike protest. Yeah. I don't want to be here. This isn't, you know, these people aren't my friends. I don't understand this language. By the time it came to the second term, I think I'd sort of gotten over myself and I thought, actually, this isn't bad. I'm living in rural France. It's, you know, it's a beautiful part of the world. I opened my mouth to speak and I was fluent in French.
Really?
So, yeah. And it just shows, like, you're such a sponge at that age, you know, and it had all gone in. And I
that's insane.
Yeah, I hadn't spoken up in class. I hadn't made any friends, but I'd obviously just been registering it all, listening to everything. And by the time I decided to speak, it was all there.
Yeah.
And it's bizarre. I mean, I couldn't do that now if I went to live in another country.
Yeah.
You know, it'd probably take having lessons and, you know, living somewhere for a few years. But at that age, I think you really are a sponge. Yeah.
Track 3, Blaine. A song reminds you of your time at school.
This would be Strokes, The Modern
Secondary
Age.
Secondary school, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, this would be... it was, I think, 2001. I turned 16. And by this point, I was living back in the UK. My parents had... they hadn't got back together, but they'd sort of buried the hatchets and they were friends again. And they decided that they wanted to put me in... They wanted to come back to England for me to go to secondary school and my sister. So I went to a school out near Reading, kind of on the outskirts of Reading. And it was a school that was... It'd actually been a school for the Merchant Navy for parents that wanted to bring their kids into the Merchant Navy once upon a time. And although that tradition isn't part of the school today, the uniforms were still there. So we had to wear these, they were called number twos. So in the week you wore, they were basically like kind of woolen knitted sweaters with patches and epaulettes, shiny shoes, berets, and then at the weekends you had to wear your number ones, which was like the full-on kind of naval regalia with the peaked cap and all the rest of it.
Was that a boarding school?
It was a boarding school. I didn't board. Yeah. I lived nearby, so I just went in as a day pupil. And I didn't fit in at all. I spent all my time in the art school just trying to escape it all, really, because I think it was one of these, like so many of those kind of private, you know, boarding schools and so on, they pride themselves on the rugby team, on the rowing team, all this kind of stuff. I mean, I've got nothing against sport. I understand the appeal of competitive sports, mm-hmm. but it's just never been for me. I've never been, you know, I wasn't made that way, you know.
Yeah.
I think my interests fall in other places, and it was very much in painting, drawing, and making music.
Was that encouraged there?
It wasn't discouraged, but it didn't feel like it was part of the culture of being at that kind of a school.
Yeah.
The facilities were decent, you know. We were taught how to produce on music software, which I actually really value, you know. So when I was 15, 16, I was learning how to use four track machines and Logic and Pro Tools and things like this. So that was one aspect of it that was that I really appreciated. But I didn't feel any kind of kinship with the other kids at school.
Did you have friends there?
Not really. No, I was bullied. I was bullied quite badly throughout my teens. And to
Why?
Be honest,
because you was different.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, essentially, I suppose I didn't fit the mold in that kind of an environment. I didn't feel like it was an environment that fostered individuality, or at least the kind of my interests didn't feel like they were the interests of most of the kids in that school. There was one or two kids that were into music, but everything sort of changed. I think it was when I came in for sixth form. It was when I turned 16 and we started year 12, and a couple of kids came in that hadn't been there for GCSEs, and they've since become my best friends in the world. So actually, out of this, quite I'd say like slightly negative experience of secondary school, I've actually found, you know, two or three people that have gone on to we're very much there for each other, and we've gone into similar fields in music and art. But that year, 2001, everything changed, and I can pinpoint it as being when we were sort of bombing off sports one afternoon, because I was, you know, as I said, I was never interested in the sort of competitive sports aspect of school, and so we were bumming around in the music hall one afternoon, and my mate Chris came in with the Modern Age EP, and he just said, "You've got to listen to this," and he put it on, and it felt like someone came in and pressed the reset button on a clock. Music in this, I mean, I think to people who are some of your, sorry, I'm just going to drink this water, my voice is going. Perhaps to some of your listeners that have, all your listeners will be familiar with the Strokes music. But I think if you were a teenager at that time, there was such a sea change when the Strokes showed up. It really felt like it felt like the dregs of Britpop. If you looked at what was kind of popping off at that time, it was new metal, it was UK garage, and I've got nothing against that kind of music, but it wasn't for me. It didn't speak to me. It didn't feel like my tribe.
Hello, I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry, it won't take a sec. All I want to say is, the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So if you want to...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hear the songs. Just go over to Spotify and search Off the Beat and Track podcast, and you can listen to all the songs because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode. So you've just got to press that one button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. And I think even on the kind of more indie side of things up until then, you know, post Britpop, you had that kind of lull where, for me, I thought it was a lull where it become the kind of era of acoustic guitars. It was Coldplay, Travis, Embrace, During Breaks, and I have no issues with them bands, but you know, I was a lot older than you at that point, but I imagine for, you know, someone 15, 16, that's not saying a lot to them, whereas the urgency of the Strokes, that's gonna change everything, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think there were some amazing records that came out in that era, but I think speaking kind of broad strokes, it wasn't an era, I think, in British music that felt dangerous or exciting.
Completely.
And when I heard that song, it just felt like, thank God someone's come to save us, you know? And I think you look at what was happening in 2001, and it was really... obviously the Twin Towers came down, you know, and New York became this focus of the world's attention. And I think there was something about the Strokes coming out of that environment, out of that, you know, I think New York was really hurting, you know, and what happened is there was a response in the musical underground to that. There's a great book, you'll probably know it, Meet Me in the Bathroom, which is very much a document of that time. And I think it conveys what I'm trying to say, yeah, which was that the world needed some kind of, it needed an explosion, a musical explosion. And I think the Strokes, they brought that. It's something just clicked. And guitar music felt rebellious again. It felt dangerous.
You mentioned Lou Reed earlier. Did hearing the Strokes make you look back as well at you know, New York bands of past years and stuff? Did you go back and, you know, because they were constantly citing,
yeah,
television, Ramones and Talking Heads and the CBGB's kind of New York. Like, was that something, did they open that up to you, or was you already quite familiar with some of the bands through the,
yeah,
stuff you was exposed to growing up?
I did. I mean, that felt like more something your dad would say, is like, oh, this is just, Lou Reed was doing this 35
yeah,
years ago, you know what I mean? But, I mean, it's interesting when you read interviews back with the Strokes from that time, because they weren't actually listening to, they didn't know who Television were.
Really?
No, they were just making it up. I mean, they were listening to, who was the band that they were really into?
Don't spoil it for me, Blaine.
It was Guided by Voices. Guided by,
right,
Voices was the band that the Strokes all, yeah, had a mutual love for.
They're in the video to, is it Strokes video where there's a game show? And they're on a game show.
I think I know the one you mean.
I don't know if it was for Someday. It might have been.
Yeah.
And Guided by Voices are the other team.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Makes sense. But I think you could hear the traces. You could hear the DNA of that music. But it didn't matter, you know. I think pop music is so cyclical. Things,
yeah,
come back around. That's just part of the fabric, I think, of the way that pop music works. So that didn't bother me. It didn't bother me that I could hear Lou Reed and their music, or, you know, or the Ramones, as you said. If anything, added to it.
Yeah, completely. That's what I meant.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And
did it open you up to the likes of the Yeah Yeah Yeahs and the other stuff that was coming out of there at that
absolutely
point?
Absolutely. Yeah, I remember going to see the Yeah Yeahs on they released the Bang EP, I think it was. And I saw them play on the at the Forum, which was a huge gig for them to play. I mean, that was before their first record, Fever to Tell, came out. So
that shows the amount of interest in what was happening in that scene at that time.
Absolutely. And obviously all the Libertine shows, which very much felt like, you know, the sort of the British response to what was happening in New York. There was such a synergy there. And we used to come down to London at the weekends, and we'd go and see, you know, all these little secret Libs shows in Whitechapel around the East End. And it just felt like, I don't know, it just felt so dangerous. And I mean, genuinely, you'd meet people at these gigs where you just thought, what rock did you crawl out from?
Yeah.
And it felt like an environment. It felt like stepping into the underground. And I think the Strokes have so much to be thanked for kind of for igniting all of that.
Absolutely. What did you want to be at school?
I wanted to be a painter. That's actually one of my terrible attempts.
There is some incredible art floating about in this, well, this amazing space.
There's bits and pieces. I mean, I'm not going to say I destroyed most of it, but I never felt like I still keep sketchbooks. I mean, I've got a sketchbook here, which is.
I mean, I looked at the notes that you've done for Greg's podcast, and even the notes look amazing.
I think a sketchbook just feels like it's very easy, particularly when you're, you know, sat on buses, you know, going to festivals and all the rest of these things. It's very easy to kind of keep a sketchbook going. I do still very much like to draw. I find it just relaxing more than anything. It's a way to kind of unwind, you know, stick on a record or a podcast and just draw. That still just brings me so much joy. And until things started picking up with the band, that's what I thought I was going to be doing. I thought I was going to be, you know, trying to sort of make my way as an artist. And I'm almost quite grateful I didn't have to, because I don't know, it feels like such a, you know, people talk about the art world being, like the fashion world or the music world being full of deceit and slightly poisonous, but I mean the art world feels very like a very tricky you know, industry to sort of navigate in. So I'm thankful that music came along and, you know, and found me, I suppose.
Okay, well we'll pick up on that now once we get this next track out of the way, which is the first song you remember buying from a record shop.
This would be, it was Sugar Coated Iceberg by Lightning Seeds.
Okay. Can you remember where you bought it?
I bought it from, so I was going to school in Oxfordshire, and I bought it from Abingdon. There was a music shop in Abingdon, which was also one of the first places to stock our demo when we made our first band demo. We took it there and they sold it for us. Trying to remember. I feel terrible that I can't remember the name of the shop.
They gave you your first foot up and you can't even remember the name of the shop.
I feel
disgraceful.
So Modern Music.
Right.
It was called Modern Music in Abingdon. I think it might still be there.
Right.
And it sold instruments. It was one of these kind of old world, you know, where you'd go in, you could buy, you know, you could rent a saxophone for school. You could buy a recorder. You could still buy sheet music. And they had a little CD section. And they had, you know, you had the CD singles. I mean, vinyl, they might have had vinyl, but this sort of preceded the vinyl
resurgence.
Yeah. Resurgence, really. So it was cassette singles, CD singles, and obviously albums. And I bought Sugar Coated Iceberg. It would have been 96. So I just moved back to the UK to go to secondary school. I would have been 11. And I remember the first time I heard the song, I was off sick from school. And I was slightly delirious, and I remember lying in bed and I was listening to, it would have been Radio 1, I guess, and it was in the charts at the time. And I just remember the sort of synth brass, the burp, 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 burp. Sorry, that's something else I'm saying. Anyway, there is synth brass in it. And there was something about it that I'd missed out on Britpop because I'd lived in France. Mm-hmm. We didn't have TV, and I didn't really listen to British radio. So the only knowledge I had of Britpop was my dad bringing out music magazines to me in the holidays. And I remember one of them had Supergrass on the cover when Ashikoko came out. And I vividly remember showing me the magazine cover and saying, "This is the enemy." which is ironic, because Supergrass were probably listening to, I was brought up on, you know, prog rock, yeah. But that's, we were probably listening to the same records, yeah. You know, like early Floyd, ELO, Hendrix, yeah. that's probably what Supergrass were listening to. And I've actually told this anecdote to Gaz, and we've had a little chuckle about it. But so when I came back to the UK, I'd missed out on Britpop, but when I went to school, kids still had bowl cuts, were still wearing like Reebok Classics, and I guess like the Euro 96 Cup had just happened. So it did still feel like this cool Britannia thing was still in the air. And when I heard the Lightning Seeds on the radio, I thought, this is great. This is what Britpop's all about. And I suppose it was the kind of, it was getting towards the end of Britpop, but it still felt like it was part of that sound. And
what about the likes of Blur and Oasis? Did that make it out to you?
I don't remember Blur. I wasn't aware of Blur, but I knew I'd seen I knew who the Gallagher brothers were, but I hadn't heard their music.
Yeah.
So I was very kind of green to Britpop in general. But that song, there was something about Sugar Coated Iceberg that had a kind of playful innocence and an imagery about it. You know, in the video, they're in this ice rink. And I don't know, it was just a cool record.
Yeah.
Actually, Ian Brody was based on Eel Pie Island.
What, producing?
For a little while, yeah. So he, Townsend used to have a barge, which was known as Eel Pie Records, and it was moored up on the island here in the 90s, and Ian Brody actually worked out of it. And interestingly, we occasionally get mail for him, and somewhere I've got a package which arrived a couple of years ago, and it was a brown envelope, and it just had 20 cardboard cutouts of Ian Brody's face in it, and no explanation.
That's great.
Absolutely no explanation. So, Ian, if you're looking for those cardboard cutouts of your face, give us a ring. I've got them.
Brilliant. Oh, I hope he didn't order his own. Oh, dear. So, did he produce the first Coral album?
He did. He did do the first Coral record. I think that was done up in Park Street in Liverpool. Right. So this would have been slightly later than, no, maybe it would have been slightly before that.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what, which records he made down here, but he was based on the island for a little while.
Okay. So deciding to sort of not pursue a career with a paintbrush, was you already playing guitar, or was you playing, or you're sitting in front of a very nice piano right now? Could you play the piano? Was you already playing music yourself?
Not really. No, I was a drummer. So drums were my first instrument. I got a secondhand knackered old drum set, I think for my 10th birthday it was. My dad had found it in the back pages of Loot. Shout out to Luke. I'm sure some of your listeners remember Luke. You know, it before you had Gumtree and all the rest of it, you had it was almost like the Yellow Pages,
yeah.
And it was all these classified ads for, you know, things that people were throwing away, and you could pick up
secondhand drum kits,
and I think he got it for 50 quid or something. I've still got it. it's still got the band's name written on the front drum skin, because I'd seen pictures of the Beatles, and that's what you had to do. You had to write your band's name on the front skin. So I was a drummer, and Will, the Jets guitarist, was he got a guitar on his 10th birthday. He got a Squire Stratocaster, which he used for many years. It was actually stolen out of our van in Sheffield on our first tour. But so I was the drummer, and Henry, my dad, played the bass. And I think our first gig was on my 11th birthday, and it was just covers. I think we played four tunes, and just to my schoolmates out in France.
What were them tunes?
We played Light My Fire.
Yeah.
We played Comfortably Numb. I think we played La Bamba. We had one original, actually. We had one original tune, which was a bit of a sort of space rock opus. It was called Moonlight Satellite, and it was about 13 minutes long. I've still got a recording of it somewhere.
Wonderful.
I think a recording still survived. And we used to make cassette demos, so we recorded our set. So we recorded the four songs with the one original song on it. But we didn't know about dubbing. We didn't know about tape dubbing, that you could record a cassette, and then you could get, you know, if you got a cassette deck with two tapes, you could dub it onto the other one. So to make copies, we'd have to re-record the songs all over again. And it took so long that we only ended up making three copies of the album. One was for me, one was for Will, and one was for EMI. And we dropped it off at EMI Records in Hammersmith. And we would have been 11. And I remember us walking in, and we just went to the front desk, because we thought this is how you got assigned.
Who was singing?
It was actually myself and my sister. She doesn't make music anymore, but she was in the first incarnation of the band, because she had a higher voice. And we didn't know about transposing songs, so we just played them in the key on the record, and I couldn't hit some of the notes, so she sang. And that was our first ever demo. So that would have been 1995, somewhere around then, and we dropped it off at EMI, and I just remember the girl at the front desk just being completely bewildered by these 11-year-olds walking in and giving her this cassette tape, and it was all hand-drawn graphics, and we still haven't heard back, EMI.
If you're listening. Oh, that's amazing. Okay, track five. The song that soundtracked your years in Clubland. Was there a Clubland?
Yes. So the club, which for me was my mecca, really, was Trash. Was Errol Alkin's Trash. That. Yeah. Did you have a go?
I did, yeah. Yeah. And I'm trying to think who else has picked Trash. Tim from Transgressive picked Trash. Russell Block Party picked Trash.
Right.
Yeah. So you're in good company there.
Yeah. Well, I remember Russell. He used to be a flyer boy, and I remember him handing out flyers for, I think it was a night at the Garage. Someone had a night upstairs at the Garage, and Russell was the flyer boy for that. So I think I remember him flying all the queues of all the gigs at that time.
I can't imagine him doing that. He's one of the shyest people I know.
I know.
Imagine him just dishing out flyers.
And you know what? He hasn't aged. He hasn't aged a day. He still looks exactly the same. He's an Essex boy, isn't he? He's an Essex boy, Russell.
He is, yeah. He's wonderful, Russ.
But yeah, so Trash at the end. I caught the. I'd say it was probably the last couple of years at Trash. It was when I left school. I left school in 2003, and I think Trash stopped in 2005 or 2006. But then it became Durr, which was basically the same club. I'm sure Errol wouldn't mind me saying that. It was the same audience, but he wanted to bring Chandra, his partner, more into it. So Durr was sort of more Chandra's responsibility, because Errol was DJing a lot more kind of around the world, because he'd become
superstar.
A superstar, which he still, I think is still seen as one of the legends in that.
He was the warm-up DJ for in my formative years of an indie clubber. I used to go to the Gas Club in Leicester Square. long gone. But there was a guy called Jeff Automatic was the resident.
I know Jeff.
Yep.
Shout out to Jeff.
Yep. So Jeff was the resident, and there was this young lad called Errol that was the warm up, and even then he was playing great records, just you know indie bangers. And then, literally years later, when I kept hearing the name Errol Olken, I was thinking, that's Errol from the Gas Club. Yeah.
It really was like. Trash was one of those places that you had to be dressed a certain way. So there was a kind of exclusivity to it, but it wasn't like the other West End clubs where, you know, you had to be smartly dressed to sort of fit the clientele. Trash was the opposite. You had to look like you hadn't made any effort at all. And people would come in, you know, I mean, actually, that's not entirely fair. I mean, it was more like, you had to make an effort to be yourself. So there wasn't a sense of a uniform. The weirder, the more kind of bushwhacked you looked, the more likely you were to be let in. And it was just rammed every week.
You can take that back to the early things like the Blitz Club and, you know, the New Romantic era and things like that. I think that's really important in creating scenes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think club culture is a junction between whatever's happening in all different cultural spaces at that time, be it fashion, be it music, be it art.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you had Dazed and Confused, you had ID, you had Super Super. So these were the kind of style Bibles of that time that were so part of that culture. And the song that instantly takes me back to that time is Standing in the Way of Control, Gossip. Perhaps even more so one of the remixes. I remember there was a Soul Wax remix, there was a La Tigra remix, there was Errol did a remix. And it really was that kind of era of the indie disco remix.
Massively.
Like, you know, if you brought out a single, you didn't put out B-sides, you put out remixes with it. You know, if you got like a Soul Wax remix or a Punk's Jump Up remix or like a
Sebastian was doing a lot.
Sebastian or a Justice remix, you know, that was the kind of Holy Grail. And it was that, I suppose it was kind of what was happening with DFA in New York and the whole kind of Electroclash thing had come over, it had taken a couple of years to come over here. But what was happening in London felt like a direct kind of counterpiece to what was happening there. Yeah. And obviously in Paris with all the Ed Banger stuff. And I think that song, it had just such a... As soon as it started, you just had that... Dan, 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 dan,
That's a call
dan,
of arms dan, right dan, there.
Dan, dan, boom, dan, boom, dan, boom.
Yeah.
And it was such a call to arms wherever you were in the club.
And it don't relent, does it?
No, it's just the most... And you just have that... Yeah. That drum beat is just like this kind of this train going through it, and it felt so refreshing to hear this like gospel vocal, you know. And she's right up there with the whoa, yeah. It was just like this such an empowering vocal, and it was this kind of anthem. It was an anthem for same-sex marriages in America under the Bush administration. So it was a protest song, I suppose, you know, if you think about it that way. But even beyond the lyrics, it just had this such a kind of unrelenting power to it. And, you know, I suppose moving on from that, you got into New Rave and, you know, I suppose the kind of... that culture going into the mainstream, and you had Skins and you had Topshop selling fluoro jeans, and before you knew it, it had killed the scene, you know, and it was dead. Yeah. But I don't think scenes are meant to last forever.
No, not
you know?
At all. That's fashion. It's got to come and go.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I think I just feel so grateful for those years at Trash.
What did you want from clubbing, Blaine?
I wanted our Hacienda, you know, I wanted our Studio 54. I wanted somewhere that, you know, I could be an individual, and somewhere that I felt that I, you know, it was a thing of finding your tribe, but actually it wasn't your tribe. It was all these, it was this kind of melting pot of different tribes, sub tribes. It was somewhere where labels didn't matter. It didn't matter what, you know, sex you were. It didn't matter what, you know, how you identified sexually, your gender. It didn't matter what your background was, what your, you know, orientation was in any sense. It was just somewhere that it was such a melting pot. And it was somewhere that, so at that time, 2004, 2005, we were making our first record actually here on the island underneath where we're sat. We had a shed, which is where we record our first record. And, I remember we were tracking, it was our first couple of singles. We recorded a song called Zoo Time, and we recorded a song called On My Feet and You Can't Fool Me, Dennis. And we, before they'd been mixed, we'd take the rough mixes down to Trash on a Monday night. This was the other thing about Trash, it was on a Monday night.
I'm a club promoter, Blaine. That's no easy thing to have a busy night on a Monday anywhere.
There you go. And I mean, I think that must have had such an impact on the demographic, because if you had a proper job, you couldn't go clubbing on a Monday night. But we were all so young, you know, we were 17, 18. I mean, there were definitely older people as well that would just kind of ride on through the weekend and still come down. But so we take these unmixed, rough mixes of our songs we'd recorded downstairs. We'd take them down to Trash on a Monday night, and we'd hand the CD to Errol, and he'd take it without even listening to it. He'd cue it up, and he'd play the track, and he'd play us out. He'd just look at the tempo, and he'd cue it up in his playlist, and he'd drop the track. And because it was him, because he was this kind of, you know, arbiter of taste, he just commanded a respect and an attention. And people, the day after he played something, all the blogs would be firing up and everyone would be trying to get hold of this track. And he did a remix of Zoo Time of our first single, which he used to play. And I just thought there was something so brave about that. He wouldn't even listen to it. He'd just stick it on. And so when we were making our second record, we went to him and we said, you know, would you like to produce our record? And he did. So he produced 21. And you know, he's since gone on to become, you know, an incredibly reputable producer. You know, he's made two Ride albums. He made the Late the Pier record. He made the Long Blondes record. Again, two albums that I associate so much with that time.
Oh, Late the Pier. Wow. Yeah. What an album.
Yeah.
Track 6. Your favourite song from an artist from your home county?
Okay. This was really difficult. I found this really hard because I don't really, I think, like I was trying to say earlier, this idea of home.
Yeah.
I'm from London, but I grew up in France and I went to school in Oxfordshire. Now the band's based here in Twickenham on Eel Pie Island. So I don't really know where home is. Home is sort of wherever my family is. We are pretty much based here now, so I thought I'd go for a Twickenham artist, and I chose Robert Wyatt. Robert Wyatt wasn't born in Twickenham, so he was born in Bristol, and obviously was very associated with the sort of Canterbury folk scene, with Soft Machine and Matching Mole, which was another band he had of the 70s, but he lived in Twickenham for many years. He lived in Twickenham, I think, from about 75 till the late 80s or even 90s, just over the river. So literally the other side of this park, there's a little road that comes down to the river. And that's where he lived with his partner, Alfie. Robert Wyatt is a hero of mine. I think he's someone that his records don't sound like anyone else's. I mean, you put on a Robert Wire record and it is just so him through and through. He kind of has this whole musical world, you know, he paints with these colours which is so idiosyncratic. I think, you know, there's jazz in there, there's ambient music, there's kind of patchwork, like sound collage. He first and foremost obviously he was a drummer. He was the drummer in Soft Machine. Some people will know Robert Wyatt's story, others won't. I mean, basically when he was 21 or 22, he was at a house party and he had been drinking tequila and Southern Comfort cocktails all night, which apparently he'd learnt from Keith Moon. It was Keith Moon's favourite drink. And so
never take drink advice from Keith Moon.
There you go. and he fell out of a fourth story window, and he attributes the fact that he survived to the fact that he was so out of it that his body, you know, being so inebriated meant that he essentially
Fight the fall.
He couldn't exactly. And so he survived the fall, but he became paralyzed from the waist down. And that really actually had, I'd say, quite a profound effect on the music that he subsequently went on to make. You know, he was still able to play the drums, but only top kit, so sort of cymbals and snare. He played the trumpet. He's an amazing trumpet player as well. And he has these beautiful, very soft vocals. Shipbuilding was an Elvis Costello song that he covered and is probably his best known hit, I suppose. You know, he played it on Top of the Pops. But Rock Bottom is the record that he made in that recovery period from that accident. And it's an album, I think it'd be wrong to say that it's about the tragedy that happened to him, because he had started writing some of the songs before the accident, but he'd recorded it in that period of recovery when he was essentially cooped up in bed, and he got the Virgin Records mobile recording studio brought to his house, and that's how he recorded it. So essentially just sat in bed and he recorded all his parts that way, and it was produced by Nick Mason from Pink Floyd, who actually helped to fund the record, because they'd put on two fundraising gigs for to support Robert in his recovery. And he was also given given the house in Twickenham by Julie Christie, by the actress. So lots of people came in to sort of help that record come to life. And it feels like there's such a hopefulness and a resilience coupled with this sort of underlying melancholy that runs throughout the album. And the first song on the record is a song called Sea Song. When I got the record, it was a recommendation by a friend, and it came out on the Ryko Disc label. And Ryko Disc used to release all their CDs in these kind of green, translucent green CD cases. And there was something about that CD case with the music, with the imagery and the lyrics, that had this, that gave the album this kind of underwater feeling. So whenever I hear the music, I feel like I'm kind of immersed in it. And it had such an impact, I think, on me also as a vocalist, because Robert Wyatt is someone that sings so, his voice is so his own. You know, he no one sings like Robert Wyatt. He's got such a unique timbre and a kind of a delicateness, a fragility to his voice. And I think that was also definitely a big influence on me as a vocalist, you know, in terms of singing in your own voice.
Wonderful. Last track. You can play DJ now, and it's your opportunity to recommend a song that people may not know.
Okay. I'm going to choose a song which is called Hammond Song by a band called The Roaches.
Okay.
They're not very well known. The Roaches were a... they were three sisters. They came out of the Greenwich Village folk scene in the 70s, late 60s, 70s. They were actually Paul Simon's backing singers on There Goes Rhyming Simon on his solo record. So a bit like Leonard Cohen, you know, he used to take around female backing singers on tour, and they appeared on his record as well. They didn't make their own record until I think it was 78, 79 even. And it's just called The Roaches. The first is the self-titled first record. And it was produced by Robert Fripp from King Crimson. King Crimson are probably, out of any artist, I think I'd attribute the reason as to why I make music with the band to King Crimson. That, you know, hearing their records was very much you know, the conduit in us wanting to make music as a band. And I'm a huge fan of everything that Fripp's done, you know, all his collaborations. Obviously most known for playing the guitars on Heroes, that kind of sustained guitar sound, and you can hear that in this song, in Hammond Song by the Roaches. It's got that kind of Eno Bowie Berlin sound. It's got that feeling about it, and yet it's this sort of pastoral Laurel Canyon-esque beautiful meandering folk song with these three-part harmonies by the three sisters. And it's just a beautiful record. Whenever I make mixtapes for people, I like to make a lot of mixtapes for friends, it always goes on there. It's just one of those songs that transports you to somewhere else, kind of to another time. It's got this kind of wonderful plaintive sort of innocence about it. And I think those harmonies that you only get with kind of family bands, you know, be it the Wilsons or, you know, whoever it is, there's something about the quality of siblings singing together. There's this kind of, it's almost like a telepathy to the way their voices work. And you can really hear that in the Roaches' music. So yeah, it's a wonderful record. I encourage anyone listening to go out and check it out.
Well, there'll be a Spotify playlist to accompany this with all the songs that we've spoken about. So hopefully they're on Spotify.
Yeah, I think they are.
Right,
they are.
Wonderful. Then we'll definitely add that so people can go and check that out. Blaine, what's happening now? Mystery Jets, what's going on?
Yeah, so we've got a new record coming out. It was actually meant to be out, but I had to have some surgery a few weeks ago, which meant that we essentially our touring plans got scuppered for the year. So this is actually why I invited you down here today, is because
I'm really glad you did, because I've never recorded anywhere like this. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's a lovely spot, and I'm essentially here for the next few months just recouping from my operation, but really looking forward to bring out the record at the beginning of next year. I think we're
done.
It was all finished actually at the end of last year, so we were sitting on it to be released in September, but that's now going to be January, February. So as long as we haven't fallen out of love with all the songs, I'm really looking forward to getting out and getting on the road and, you know, playing that record live. So that's what's on the cards. But in the meantime, I'm here and I'm just trying to, I suppose, just keep myself busy. You know, I'm reading quite a lot. I've got my old four-track machine out, my Porter studio, so I'm making some demos and doing things like this, which is really interesting for me to
do. Well, I'm glad that you've given up a bit of your time today to do this. Blaine, I've absolutely loved doing this.
Brilliant. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. There you have it. How lovely is Blaine? We sat and chatted afterwards as well, and it was a really, really lovely couple of hours. And I hope you got as much joy out of that as I did recording it. I'm back next week with another episode. If you've not looked before, please go and have a look in the back catalogue of this podcast, because you can hear me having pod chats with stacks and stacks of really amazing creative people, whether they be musicians, artists, DJs, producers, actors. Go and have a look in the archives and see if there's anything there that you like. And if you're listening on iTunes, then give us a rating. And yeah, and if you see us on the social medias, then give us a like, love, share, retweet, because it all helps. And also, if you want even more content, I put a unique episode up each week on Patreon. So go and search Patreon, Patreon, off the beaten track, and go over there and have a little look at all the things you can get from there. The one-stop shop for everything is offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. I'll see you next week. Thank you. Bye-bye. Oh, yeah. Sorry. I've butted in yet again. I just want to quickly tell you about this magazine. It's called Pod Bible. Now, Pod Bible is the new essential guide to podcasts. It's put together alongside Spotify and Acast, and it's a one-stop shop to tell you all about the podcasts you maybe know about, but definitely about a load of the podcasts that you probably don't know about that we think you should know about. I mean, in the first edition, there's interviews with Adam Buxton, interviews with Craig Parkinson. There's features on Jade Adams, and there's just an abundance of information about so many exciting podcasts that are out there. Also, Spotify have given us these amazing little codes. So if you do get a print copy, you can just turn on your Spotify on your phone, scan the little code, and it just automatically opens up the podcast on your listening device. How good's that? If you haven't managed to get a print copy, then just go over to www.podbiblemag.com and read it online, because the digital version is all over there and it's all free. So every other month there'll be a new edition out. So go and have a look and support us on the social medias as well. Podbiblemag.com. It's Off the Beaten Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.